Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of my Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on October 14, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our discussion is on the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the sutta on the not-self characteristic. This sutta explains how a wrong view of self arises and how the interrelationship between this wrong view of self within an impermanent environment results in ongoing dukkha or ongoing suffering. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. This morning's talk is on the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the sutta on the not-self characteristic. And this is one of the first three discourses, teachings the Buddha ever gave. It's considered one of the three cardinal discourses. And these first three discourses really present the Buddha's entire Dhamma in the context of the three marks of existence, of impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and resulting dukkha. His first discourse, his first sutta, was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, where he taught the Four Noble Truths. And in a general way, the Four Noble Truths point to impermanence. The third discourse that he gave, the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, the Sutta on the Fire Discourse, develops the understanding of dukkha arising from the passions of a self-referential ego self attempting to establish and maintain itself. And this second discourse explains the not-self characteristic. And the insight that's gained through the entire Eightfold Path is insight into impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and dukkha. And the reason why I say that is we can get fixated or overly mindful on gaining insight into everything that's arising. In fact, there's some schools of Buddhism that teach insight kind of in that way, just to be, again, overly mindful or fixated on everything that's arising. And that can be just another distraction. The Buddha taught to gain insight into these three marks of existence so that we understand what's occurring in the world and our own contribution to stress, deluded thinking, and ongoing distraction. So the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta explains how a wrong view of self arises and how the interrelationship between this wrong view of self within an ever-changing or impermanent environment results in ongoing suffering. And that's the whole process that takes place that leads to a life of suffering and disappointment. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Benares in the deer park at Esipatana. There he addressed a group of five bhikkhus. This is, remember, this is his second discourse. His first discourse was to his five friends that he had wandered around northern India with previously, prior to his awakening. And now this is his second teaching to them.
John, what's a bhikkhu?
A bhikkhu is simply, another word would be a mendicant, somebody who has decided to follow the Buddha's teachings and leave the world behind. In other words, they're now devoted to that life rather than being part of the world. Good question. And so, as with all of the discourses, it's important to not lose the context. So this isn't something that the Buddha first taught his teachings, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Nothing happened, and 3 weeks later, he pops up and he's going to teach this. There was an ongoing conversation between him and these five friends, and so this sutta is in response to some general questions that were arising in that initial sangha. So the Buddha continues: bhikkhus, form is not self, meaning this physical body, but then extrapolating that to the entire phenomenal world. Form is not self. Were form self, then this form would not lead to suffering. And one could have it be any form desired and stress-free. What the Buddha is saying is that because you're attached to this physical form, and you have, because of that attachment, giving up any type of control. You think that this is you, and what's happening to this form is determining your experience. In other words, you've lost control. How could it be a self? He's pointing out something obvious. If you're not in control of it, how could it be a self? It's really a simple and direct question. But you can see how it has arisen from their interaction in the few weeks since the Buddha gave his first teaching.
Since form is not self, it leads to suffering, and none can have it be any form desired, and so stress-free. The Buddha continues, because feeling is not self, as perceptions are not self, fabrications are not self, and consciousness is not self. So what he's referring to there, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness, are the five clinging aggregates, which simply describe the ongoing personal experience of suffering. Because they're somewhat unfamiliar terms and we have a hard time initially making the connection between the five aggregates, those five elements, it seems like a difficult concept, but it really isn't. It's simply describing life as life occurs from a self-referential point of view. Is that relatively clear? Okay, good. If these aggregates were self, they would not lead to suffering, and one could direct these aggregates as one wished. So probably the easiest way to look at that, if we could direct it, is that last part of consciousness. Now remember, this is not some grand cosmic consciousness that we're all somehow a part of. It's consciousness rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So it's ongoing conditioned thinking. And if our thinking, if we could direct our thinking in such a way that it didn't cause stress, it didn't react to things occurring, then we would have mastered the Dhamma, wouldn't we? In the Vitakasanthana Sutta that I'll be teaching on Tuesday night, the Buddha closes that sutta with saying, we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. That requires a mind that is free of a self-referential view, a view rooted in wrong views, and a mind that is constantly functioning within the framework of the Eightfold Path, seeing things clearly. And in that way, that we would have control of our feelings. And I don't mean control in a, again, overly mindful, watchful, or constricting way. Whatever occurred would occur in our lives without any reaction. And that's really the best description of a feeling in this sense, any disturbance in the mind. And because of that, we wouldn't be forming perceptions based on how we're feeling, based on those reactions. And those feelings wouldn't further mental fabrications, which are assumptions rooted in ignorance, and they wouldn't feed that ongoing conditioned thinking. We would be in control of that whole process. And again, that's what the Buddha's talking about. If we're not in control of it, it's not a self. It's a self rooted in ignorance. The Buddha used that term anatta, not to say that there's no such thing as a self, which is how this is often taught, anatta, that somehow there's nothing here and the self is just part of some grand cosmic emptiness or void. That's not what the Buddha is saying. He's simply saying that the views that you're holding of a self are wrong views. They don't constitute a self, and that's what he's referring to here. If you had control of it, if you don't have control of it, how could it be a self? How could you not be in control of yourself? Remember, see it in the larger context. If we were in control of ourselves, we wouldn't be contributing to dukkha from confused thinking, deluded thinking, and reacting to a continually unsatisfactory experience. We would understand the process. Is that clear? Because that's really an important point here. The idea that we gain control of how we think. And most people don't even want to... That's almost... Using the word control is something... There's a subtle underlying teaching or feeling in the world that we shouldn't be in control of anything, which is just ridiculous. We should be in control of ourselves. We should be in control of the way we think and the way we feel and the way we form perceptions about the world, but in a way that's rooted in wisdom of how things really occur. And in that way, it's a very gentle and spacious type of control. It's not a constricting or confining place. It's simply understanding the world we live in and our relationship to it. Go back one sentence. If these aggregates were self, they would not lead to suffering, and one could direct these aggregates as one wished. So again, that line, even that one sentence, says that the aggregates themselves are not unskillful. But when we cling them together from wrong view, then they become a problem and they become a vehicle for ongoing suffering. But seen individually in their discreteness, they're simply how we experience life. And again, this, I don't want to get too far off this sutta, but this points to the idea of reconciliation of all things into one kind of spiritual view, that we're all one thing. And that contradicts the Buddhist teachings to see things in their discreteness. And if you look at that idea of cosmic reconciliation, that we're all part of one giant organism, what is that? It's one giant clinging organism, isn't it? We've taken the personal experience of five clinging aggregates and now created a cosmic view that reflects five clinging aggregates. And that just furthers confusion, deluded thinking, and creates ongoing suffering. But now on a cosmic scale, it's just a distraction. It's just something rooted in ignorance. Since these are not self, they can only lead to suffering, and no one can have these aggregates be as they wish. Bhikkhus, how do you perceive this form? Is form permanent or impermanent? The five replied, it's impermanent. Now, what is impermanent? Is it painful or pleasant? It's painful. Why is it painful? Because we're identifying with this form, insisting that it's permanent when it can't be. It's changing every moment, and it's prone to sickness, it's prone to aging, and it's prone to death. Just that impermanent and unsatisfactory experience is painful when we identify it that way. The Buddha continues, now what is impermanent, what is painful, since subject to change, is this fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself? Why would you want to? Why would you want to create an identity with something that is so subject to the vagaries of impermanence? You know, the reason why I'm using that sentence, vagaries of impermanence, what is impermanent is also uncertain. We can never know what's going to happen. And so there's an underlying tension to simply identifying yourself in a permanent way as this is me, this is mine, this is who I am. The bhikkhus reply, no, venerable sir. Well then, is feeling permanent or impermanent? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Are fabrications permanent or impermanent? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? All are impermanent, venerable sir. Now, is what is impermanent, what is painful since subject to change, is this fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself? No, venerable sir. So bhikkhus, any kind of form whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external. Now, the Buddha is pointing out to this, even during the Buddha's time, this cosmic view of a unified self as part of one gigantic cosmic organism. And also the notion that there was this permanent self going infinitely back into the past and will be established somehow infinitely into the future. It's all part of this wrong view of self. Whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, meaning a spiritual, so-called spiritual body, whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, whether far or near, must, with right understanding how it actually is, be regarded as this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. So no matter what strategies we're using to establish this idea of a permanent self in any realm, and the Buddha's referring in these different qualifications, he's pointing to the strategies that were in place at that time of establishing the self in different realms and different bodies, cosmically, mystically, esoterically, in the past, in the future, here, there, everywhere. He's saying they're all false views of self. Let go of them. And if you think about the underlying energy needed to maintain the self in all these imaginary states, how distracting and how stressful can that be? And yet, on a subtle way, we're doing that all the time. We may not be consciously aware of trying to do it in mystical realms, like the Buddha's referring to here, but we're doing it in a general way just by thinking that we can establish a permanent self all the time. The idea of an individual soul that travels from one life to the next through mercy or grace or good works is part of that. And that's one of the most prevalent beliefs in modern Buddhism too, something that the Buddha discounted and taught to be wary of 2,600 years ago. And the reason why is these beliefs were rooted more in the Vedas and later the Upanishads, which the Buddha studied and rejected, is not leading to the goal. And I'm not putting down those teachings or what they led to, the modern Hindu religions. but only to point out that what has developed in the 2,600 years since the Buddha's passing, since his teachings, modern Buddhism has more relationship to the Vedas and the Upanishads, something the Buddha rejected, than it does to what the Buddha actually taught. And again, I'm just pointing out the differences. I got to keep qualifying that because people get mad at me when I say that. But it's just the truth, and you can see it very clearly in this, the second discourse the Buddha ever gave. Lost my place. Sorry about that. Okay. And so it follows that any kind of feeling whatever, any kind of perception, any kind of assumption, any kind of consciousness whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding of how it actually is, be regarded as this is not mine, this is not me, this is not myself. Again, the Buddha is pointing specifically to self-referential views, isn't he? Any wrong view of self is a self-referential view because we're seeing it and we're using the object or the event for further establishment of wrong views. We're seeing ourselves in it. We're clinging ourselves to it. And it could be something as mundane as a zafu, as a meditation pillow. I think I use this Thursday night. I don't like purple meditation pillows, purple zafus. So I'm offended by that. I have great aversion. I wish it wasn't in the room. But the black zafu is okay. Do you see the self-identification in that? I'm using a very simple and mundane example. Who cares what the color is? But we make those kind of preferences all the time. And some people might actually object to purple. But it's because of the self-identification that creates a distraction in my mind and starts putting a condition on my life in this present moment. In order for me to be happy, I need to have only black zafus in my life. If there's any notion of a purple zafu, or even a possibility, I'm going to be worried. I'm going to be concerned about that. Again, a very simple and maybe too simple explanation of how we create identities over mundane objects. And we do this with all types of things. Here, there, and everywhere. Things that have no meaning at all, no bearing on who I am in this present moment, I create conditions on how I'm going to feel about that. And that's a conditioned mind. That's what that means. Confirmation bias is another word for that. I'm biased towards seeing things in a way that confirms my view that the only right cushions are black cushions. And all purple cushions are wrong cushions. Now, of course, again, a simple example, but we do that with individuals. We do it with all types of preferences between people. We do it with preferences between different countries, don't we? We do it with all preferences, which is another word for a view. And if those views are rooted in ignorance, they can only lead to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering for ourselves and others. So we can create whole worlds, whole nations that say black cushions are the only right cushions and purple cushions are the wrong cushions. And we'll go to war over it, won't we? To defend something as silly as that. We've done it. We're doing it today. We take these notions and we expand them to such an extent that it seems reasonable to create suffering over them, don't they? But they're as meaningless as going to war over different colors of cushions. Because all of these things that we think are so important are all impermanent. They don't matter. And they certainly shouldn't be used to create a self-identity or a global identity over them. The Buddha talked about this 2,600 years ago.
That's changing the world.
Well, it would if people would take to it. But now remember, the Buddha didn't see himself as a savior or his Dhamma as salvific. But if more people would take to it, it certainly would change the world. I think it has changed the world, Diana. I mean, it hasn't changed the entire world, but it certainly has changed individuals that have taken to the Dhamma during the Buddha's time and now our time. But again, the goal isn't salvation, although within it there is the possibility. But if we take on the idea that the Dhamma now has to be salvific in nature, then we'll become over-engaged Buddhists and try to save the world and lose the sight of the fact that the first thing we need to save, the first person that needs to awaken is ourselves. And in that way, we can have a helpful effect on other people.
John?
Yes?
When I'm connected to, I'm more mindful of the Buddha teachings and thinking about the five pinya aggregates, and I'm aware that I'm making choices, just as you've explained, and I withdraw from making the choices, it feels like I'm just very bland. It feels like I'm not maybe participating in life or engaged in life like it should be. But it doesn't feel like there's relief, and it doesn't feel like there's a big open space in my mind or anything. It just feels like blur, you know, because I'm just not... reacting or playing the game of life or whatever you can describe it. So in a way, it's not, if I see the clinging aggregates, and when I'm mindful of the clinging aggregates and fall back and not take the way of the clinging aggregates in my mind, in my thinking, I don't feel I'm stepping forward in my Dharma practice, because I just don't feel anything. I mean, that's, you know, it doesn't fulfill anything in me.
I
just feel bland and blur.
Yes, so thank you. It's so important. In the past, because we've had these conversations, you were excited and mindful, in a mindful way, of what you were developing in Dhamma practice. And now you're having an experience of blandness.
Yeah.
Notice the impermanence of all that. And it's important. When we're not feeling inspired and excited, that can often, an ego personality will say, well, nothing's occurring. This isn't good. I'm not happy. I'm not distracted. So there's a period, a period of undoing, where it feels like that. It feels like annihilation. It feels like I'm completely estranged, and I'm using that word for a reason too, estranged from the world. But it really is just that. It's coming to grips with the fact that there is nothing useful in establishing a self-referential ego self in any way. And at times it feels bleh, there's nothing going on. Well, underlying that feeling that there's nothing going on is the truth, that there's nothing going on. So, and it feels, it's disconcerting. It's justification to get off the path. When you look at it, again, this is where the framework of the Eightfold Path comes in. When you look at it through the developing right view of the Eightfold Path, you can see exactly what's occurring. And that you're taking even the process of awakening, of developing full human maturity, too personal. So what's the solution? Right effort is there for a reason. It's the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. You continue with Dhamma practice even when doesn't feel inspiring. Because you've developed the overall framework to even understand that ongoing process. It's such an important question that you've asked, because it's that feeling of blandness, which is another way of saying real boredom, the lack of sensory stimulation even in Dhamma practice, that causes people to give up. Because that allows every single one of the five hindrances to come into your mind and give it validity. I'm no longer sensory stimulated, the first hindrance. You know, nothing's going on. And you said it yourself. I feel bland. I feel bored. The second hindrance comes in, ill will. You start directing it at yourself and also at the Dhamma. Well, this can't be good or useful. Look how I feel. Nothing. Doubt and skepticism come in immediately, don't they? And often restlessness and drowsiness will be a part of that, because you're no longer inspired. You don't even have the energy to sit sometimes. You certainly don't have the energy to maybe read a little bit, read Becoming Buddha, read more of the suttas, right?
Yeah.
It's all part of that. And it's felt like felt as part of the five clinging aggregates. It's felt like boredom. It's felt like blah. So the Dhamma, what we're insisting in that moment when we're feeling meh, the Dhamma has to be exciting. The Dhamma has to be a distraction or I'm not going to use it anymore. Mm-hmm. That's what we're saying to ourselves. And it's an incredibly subtle and powerful strategy that anatta, a self-referential ego self, will employ to get itself back, to maintain control of itself. Eva, did you have a question or a comment?
I was going to say that it's sort of like the death throes of the ego. It's being tamped down where you want it and saying, no, can't, this is boring, this is not, And so you got to push through and then see where you end up on the other side.
Yeah.
Could I offer something?
Please.
It's interesting listening to Lorna. My experience is exactly the opposite. Because I feel like I'm so engaged in things, like I could be fighting all these litigation battles in my head, that I'm not allowing life to go as, to come and go as it should.
Yeah.
And when I'm able to do that, it feels blissful, and I feel spaciousness, and I'm happy about it. So it's exactly the opposite of what Lorna's experiencing. So I think that those are just, those are mind states.
That's right.
It's just what it is. It's just the mind state.
It's what's arising in you in that moment to continue distraction as a strategy to continue distraction or not. And the same thing with Lorna.
So I say, why can't I disengage more? And I get angry at that.
Yep. And again,
when I have those moments when I'm not, I'm very happy about it.
Yes.
I'm happy to let life pass.
Thank you both for bringing that up, because you're showing both extreme views of how to say, well, the Dhamma doesn't work because of how you're feeling and how you're looking at life in this moment, or how it does too. So the important point of that is that the Eightfold Path brings every possible occurrence within it, if we're resting in that refined mindfulness, to see things clearly, whether it's a feeling of boredom and estrangement from the world or over-engagement as a distraction. It covers both of those. It covers all of those. I shouldn't say both. It's not just two views. It's every type of view or strategy that we would develop and employ to maintain anatta within the framework of the Eightfold Path. It's seen and abandoned as, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am in that moment. So when that feeling comes up, and I think you're doing it anyway, remind yourself, well, this feeling of blah is not me. It's just a feeling of blah. It's a temporary feeling that arises from conditioned thinking. And that when you're over-engaged, recognize that. This is not me. This is not who I am. This is just a distraction that's arising from the conditions and events of my own life.
That's why it's the middle road.
Yeah. Let me continue. Bhikkhus, when a noble follower who has heard the truth sees in this way, meaning recognizing the foolishness of eye-making in all those situations, they find estrangement in form. And the word estrangement is a good word, because what it means is there's no longer an identity with form. It's strange to me. This is not me. I don't know this at all. Meaning you've lost all clinging wrong views in relation to the form. They find estrangement in form. They find estrangement in feeling, meaning there's no longer self-identification with my feelings. They're just feelings. They're just what's arising in the world. They find estrangement in perceptions. They find estrangements in assumptions and fabrications. They find estrangement in consciousness, meaning you've now disidentified yourself, I don't know if that's the right word, with your ongoing thought process rooted in ignorance. Doesn't mean you stop thinking. But you've now gained the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it. It's no longer self-reflective. It's no longer rooted in wrong views. When they find estrangement, passion fades out. And that's that passion for constant sensory stimulation to establish myself. So you're having that experience of passion fading out. With the fading of passion, they are liberated. It's not that hard to understand, is it? Well, it's the next step. And again, the Buddha's not teaching something, this long process of appeasing to gods and goddesses and divas and other things that's going to take millions of lifetimes. With the fading of passion, they are liberated. That happens right now. His next discourse, which was given about a month after this, was on the fires of passion, the fire of discourse. And these are all in my book, and they're all really the foundation for our retreats, too, so they're on the retreat talks. There is knowledge, they are liberated. They understand. This is the big understanding. When the Buddha describes right view, this is what he's describing. They understand that birth is exhausted. There's no longer a possibility of giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. That's the important part of birth. But we're also talking about no longer giving the possibility of giving birth to another physical life prone to dukkha. Birth is exhausted. The integrated life has been lived out. In the translations, integrated is usually translated as holy. But I use the word integrated because there's nothing religious or even spiritual about what the Buddha's teaching. And integrated is a better description of what it means. And in the translated sense of using holy, they mean holistic. But it's more clear that integrated means we have integrated the Eightfold Path. The integrated life has been lived out. What can be done is done. The only thing that can be done, the only thing that's really useful or skillful in engaging in, outside of the mundane activities of taking care of ourselves, meaning providing for food, shelter, clothing, medicine, what can be done is done. Of this, there is no more beyond. There's nothing beyond this. There's nothing more important than developing the Dhamma. Now, during this discourse, this is the concluding part of the sutta. Now, during this discourse, the hearts and minds of the bhikkhus were liberated from craving, aversion, and deluded thinking. That last line is saying that during the Buddha's first discourse, one of these gentlemen, Kandana, understood the Dhamma so completely that he awakened. At the end of this second discourse, the other four awakened because they understood the three marks of existence. Now, in the book, I'll just refer to that because I don't think I'll be teaching the fire discourse except on retreat anytime soon. In that discourse, he's speaking to 1,000 followers. So the Buddha's popularity grew pretty quickly. And now he's describing the problem of dukkha arising from the passions of creating and maintaining a self-referential self. I just explained that. So, my commentary, just a little bit. As a result of wholehearted engagement with the Eightfold Path, disenchantment with the ego self, with anatta, with the five clinging aggregates is developed. From disenchantment with the five clinging aggregates comes the cessation of the compulsive need to continually establish an ego personality. There's simply no vehicle left to drive that need for maintaining self-referential views. Once disenchantment is established, the process of unbinding begins. The cessation of delusion, confusion, and continued unsatisfactoriness is now possible. The simplest way to describe the Buddha's teaching on not-self is this. Anything the ego self clings to, whether objects, people, events, views, or ideas, or craving through the pursuit of happiness through the acquisition of objects, people, events, views, or ideas, will create confusion, disenchantment, and lasting unhappiness. The futility of creating self-identity by clinging to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas becomes apparent. We simply recognize how foolish this is to try to maintain something that itself only contributes to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointment. We just let it go. Again, I'm saying that because we don't have to get into the analysis of this. Where did it come from? Why am I doing it? Who else might be responsible for this? Who else is acting in this way? It doesn't matter. Recognize the futility of it and what it's causing in your own life, and you'll simply let it go. I just want to cover one more point. So association is another word for clinging or for attachments. Who is associated with and what is associated with defines the experience of self. So whatever we're associating ourselves with to create an identity is going to determine our experience. And this does not, well, let me read it because I'll say this too many times. This does not mean that there should be no associations. It does show the importance of being mindful of all associations and to not attempt to make what is impermanent permanent. meaning whether we're identifying ourselves as part of a larger group and maintaining an identity that way, or simply the, and probably more important, the associations we create as part of, excuse me, a Dhamma practice or a so-called spiritual practice. Because many of us have just to use the word, dabbled in a lot of different things. It might be a little bit of yoga, a little bit of mindfulness this way, a little bit of Dhamma, a little bit of Tibetan, a little bit of Zen, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And that's not to say we shouldn't look at those. But as far as seeing a Dhamma practice, what we associate with that Dhamma practice is going to determine the efficacy of that Dhamma practice. And so the Buddha taught a very pure Dhamma. In fact, something that should be seen as unique in a way that we will protect it that way, to not add anything or associate anything with that. And so our Dhamma practice should be free of associations. It should be framed by the Eightfold Path. And that's really what I'm referring to, and what the Buddha uses this theme of being careful of our associations throughout his teachings. It's important to ask ourselves, do associations support developing understanding within the framework of the Eightfold Path? So one of the major rules of the, there's a second, a first book of the Pali Canon is called the Vinaya Pitaka, which is the rules for the members of the Sangha, the monks and nuns. And the most important rule there is when gathered as a Sangha, when associated as a Sangha, to only speak of the Dhamma. So even during the Buddha's time, he recognized that the beginning Sangha, they were spending a lot of time talking about, you know, well, this teacher was talking about this the other day. And what about that? And this teacher, when you're gathered as a Sangha, focus on the Buddha's Dhamma. It makes sense, doesn't it? One of the reasons why I think this Sangha has developed the way it has, which is really remarkable, it's somewhat unique, is that we maintain a great focus on just what the Buddha taught here. And that really is remarkable. There's not too many, using the word loosely, Buddhist sanghas that do just that. And the reason why, and it's in the beginning, it was a little bit more difficult for me to maintain that focus as it is now. And the reason why I did that, notice the eye making there, is because I noticed my own problem with wanting everything Buddhist to be everything Buddhist rather than just what the Buddha taught. And I've also, over the years, was part of many different sanghas that felt the need to incorporate everything so-called spiritual and say that it's Buddhist practice. And that is just distracting. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't leave here and go to a yoga class or use other mindfulness techniques. Just recognize that they're not what the Buddha taught. That's all. That's all that this means. And that's all the idea of association means.
I remember when I first joined, there were some people here that wanted to do more activist things.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There was more of you know, not that I'm glad about it, it's just what happens. Those people don't come anymore. There are people that wanted to play tapes here, listen to of different so-called Buddhist teachers, and even get into the modern psychological bent of Buddhism and have some, you know, psychiatrist slash Buddhist teachers, their teachings here. They weren't teaching what the Buddha taught. That's the only reason it was. And other things, too. Again, it doesn't mean you shouldn't listen to these other people. I don't, because I don't find any reason to. I find that what the Buddha taught is more than enough, and it keeps it simple and allows me to stay well focused, but that's all that I'm saying here. So, do associations support developing understanding within the framework of the Eightfold Path? Do associations... Boy, that's my writing that I can't make sense of. I need to edit this. Do associations promote confusion and suffering through validation of unskillful actions? The Eightfold Path provides a highly effective framework for guiding associations and focus for practice. As clinging to an ego personality ceases, self-identification with associations also ceases. So, again, that last little bit about associations also refers to the eye-making that we develop through associations, through our associations with other people, our associations with other ideas, our associations with other dharmas, our associations with black pillows or purple pillows. They're all parts of eye-making, and they should be recognized as that. The sutta on the not-self characteristic speaks directly to that. The whole point of the Dhamma is to recognize and abandon eye-making, because that eye-making is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So in that way, you can say that the Four Noble Truths that speak in a general way to impermanence also show the way of recognizing and abandoning eye-making. That's today's talk. Thank you. Any questions or questions about this talk?
Talking about associations, associations with people, associations with anything. I mean, nothing in the world is exactly how you want it to be.
Yep.
Nothing is.
Yep. That everything is has an unsatisfactory component to it.
Yes.
That's dukkha.
So, taking associations with people as an example. And given that, therefore, all people are not perfect in my eyes, and I guess I'm not perfect in their eyes, I'm probably not perfect in their eyes or their eyes or whatever. But some people are more accepting, I'm more accepting to some people, and
mm-hmm.
other people are like more. Like some people more than others. But given that there's nobody in the world that is perfect, and so where do you draw the line of it? Because the Buddha says associate with people who not necessarily follow the Dharma, but who are not opposed to the Dharma anyway. I mean, I've got friends who are very opposed to the Dharma. They've got their religion, and they are very opposed to the Dharma.
You have to keep it in context. The Buddha speaking to those that have, not that they made a formal vow, but they vowed to follow the Buddha's Dhamma within a Sangha. And that's who the Buddha is speaking to. So when you're gathered as a Sangha and you're seeing yourself as a follower of the Dhamma, only associate yourself with the Dhamma. But the Buddha, these monks and nuns were the beginning of the tradition of leaving the Sangha every day, going into town and interacting with people, not just to get their bowl of food, but also to interact with the public. And if anybody was interested, to teach them the Dhamma. So it's an extreme view that says that, well, I'm a practitioner of the Buddha's teachings, so I can't even talk to another human being. Speaking with another human being who might have different views is not association. You're not creating an identity. You're not clinging to that. It's simply being a human being in the world. The difficulty comes from your own mind, and I'm just talking about this in general sense or maybe in a possibility, that other people need to be just like me for me to interact with them. That's an extreme view. You could even say that that's bordering on prejudice. That's not what this means. Who are we associating with? What are you using to create an identity with? That's the important point. So again, we're not saying that we should never have an interaction with other people. That's an extreme view. It simply means to be clear. Now, you also point out that other people, when the Buddha describes dukkha, including in other people, in dukkha are other people. People are part of the unsatisfactory nature of life, aren't they? We should recognize it as such. Why? Because they're not who we want them to be. Not getting what is wanted is part of dukkha. Well, other people are often part of that, aren't they? The world is almost always like that. We want it to be different. That's all part of dukkha. But as far as Dhamma practice is what we're talking about. That's what we should strive to maintain as pure. Again, there's such a powerful push within Buddhism and within all religions to say all religions are basically the same. They all have the same goal, kind of the same teachings. We should see them all as one. And I'm not going to get too deeply into this, but I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing extremists, because they resent the fact that you're saying that my personal religion is just like everyone else. It's not. Even one of the big leaders of modern Buddhism says that repeatedly. All religions are the same. All Buddhists is the same. It's not. But that's what I'm talking about. That's what the Buddha's talking about, is about associations. We should be careful about that, because it points to the discreteness of it. This is what it is. It doesn't need to be anything else. And other teachings don't have to be the same as this. Your friends that object to Buddhism, okay.
I think I'm making a mistake, which is just occurred to me since we were talking just then, that I'm being judgmental of other people. When they don't follow my ideas, they're wrong and I'm right.
Well, yeah, if you're doing that, because that's taking it personally.
Yeah.
That.
And I think that's probably what I'm referring to. That
yeah.
To accept that there is dukkha in the world, and this is part of the dukkha.
Other people are part of dukkha.
Right.
You know, again, that's not a complete blanket statement, but if you're... In general, if your life is rooted in ignorance, you can only contribute to the dukkha of the world. So the only thing we can do is to awaken, so we don't do that on a personal level. But again, we do that all the time, don't we? Because other people, thank you for bringing it up. We take other people being different than us, especially something as important as a Dhamma practice, whether it's Buddha-focused or modern Buddhism, we take it personally because... It's so important to us. We have such a strong identity with it that it's challenged when other people aren't doing it. Or might, in our minds, diminish it in some way by not agreeing with us 100%. We were talking a little earlier, just before class, Lorna and Ram and I. You'd be surprised at some of the emails I get from folks, because I'm so wonderful and I shouldn't get it, from saying that this is what the Buddha taught and he didn't teach that. But it's just the mystical legends about how the Buddha could have taught a million different dhammas in 45 years are, when you look at them, are, they're unfathomable. It's just not possible that this could have taken place, yet people insist that it did. And how that happened is sometimes I don't want to go there. The point of this is to watch out for eye making in everything we do, and in particular our Dhamma practice. Are we trying to make it fit our own views, our own wrong views, or are we using it to develop an understanding of my own wrong views? The only way to do that is to keep it pure, isn't it? Or else the tendency will be to create strategies within our Dhamma practice to continue to ignore ignorance. So, great question. Thank you. Any other questions on the sutta? We'll just go around the room quickly. Great. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good morning. I don't have a lot to contribute, but I did find the talk wonderfully insightful. Thank you.
Thank you. Glad you're here. Margaret, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good. I don't have much to contribute either. I'm just absorbing and listening.
Great. I'm glad you're here. Yeah. Eva, good to see you. It is. I'm glad you're here. Mary, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. The talk, as usual, was very insightful. And
thank you.
Gives me a lot of food for thought. And, I get very upset about when I'm reading the newspaper to the point where I want to stop reading the newspaper.
Yeah, so stop.
But I need to try to remember that everything's impermanent. What is happening is impermanent.
Yeah.
Agitated about it, but it's hard.
Yeah. It really is.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I mean, it's just hard. I mean, I had to cut off a friendship with someone because she just went into this big tirade, and I had to just walk out the door and just say, okay, this is done. Try not to, it's not that I took it personally, but try not to, I'm not sure how, I just had to walk away.
Yeah. A wise disassociation.
Yeah.
You know, it really is. And that's exactly the response there. Thank you, Mary. I'm glad you're here. There, it does seem like the what's going on in the world is increasing in tension. And I guess in some way it is. But 2,600 years ago, the Buddha awakened. He looked out on the world and he said, the world is aflame. Hasn't changed much in a general way since then. And the problem of that inflammation is ignorance. You know, when you can you can certainly, when you read the paper or watch the news, you can certainly see that coming up all the time in different people from different sides of the spectrum too. So it seems like an increasingly more difficult time, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't, that really doesn't matter. What can we do to maintain a calm and peaceful mind is to learn to see things clearly. Dukkha occurs, and it's certainly occurring a lot today, isn't it? Thanks, Mary. Lorna, good to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you. As I've sort of intimated, my practice is not firing on all four cylinders at the moment. I feel a bit disconnected with it and don't sort of have the patience in my thinking to think things through, and although I keep on meditating, of course. Just at the moment, not really fully engaged and thinking about it much, much that happened in the past. But anyway, going on the retreat next week, that will probably flip me around, and I'll be very excited to question my thoughts again and in a joyful way and inspiring way.
Thank you. Diane, good to see you this morning.
I'm glad to be here. You know, the word love is an undefinable word, and I'm not really sure I know what it means all the time, and sometimes the meaning expands, and sometimes it's narrow and stuff like that, but... I continually go back to the fact that the Buddha taught to love our, you know, the loving kindness, the metta, toward ourself first, and then toward others, and etc. And sometimes I've walked away from people, and in a self-righteous, arrogant kind of way, and I usually regret those. Sometimes I've walked away to protect myself, and in that way it's kind of loving myself. And toward the practice, for me, I'm probably not a dictionary Buddhist, but I really like the Eightfold Path and the teachings, most of the teachings, and that's probably eye making, and I check that out. But the point I'm trying to make is when I run into the boredom, I, long time ago, read somewhere that boredom is thinking of myself and too much. And then I keep, when I hit those bumps, I just keep thinking about, I seem to come back to this love thing. Am I loving myself? May I be filled with loving kindness? Kind of gentles out all the other thoughts, mm-hmm. and smooths them to what the moderation kind of thing, not necessarily a passionate, energetic kind of thing, but just an accepting, but gentle something.
Yeah. Thank you. We'll finish as we always do with metta, because it's such an important aspect of the Dhamma, is learning to be gentle towards ourselves, and then we can do that with others. And just another point on that, you kind of touched on it too, Diane, and Mary did. It's important to not associate with people that are insisting that we see things their way, because that's simply agitating. But there's also, by continuing to engage in people, whether it's in an adversarial situation or simply giving credence to what they're doing, often our association is a tacit approval towards something. So we need to look at it that way too. Other people will attach themselves to a group way of looking at things, even if we're just two of us are making a group, that, oh, somebody else is approving of what I'm doing, so it must be right. And we need to be careful. There's an integrity that goes along with that. And I certainly see it just from my position that, and I've had students ask me direct questions, that what I associate with, because what I associate with is going to be seen as I approve of it. You know, and that it kind of comes naturally to me. I don't associate with a lot of things besides what the Buddha taught, and it's taken a while to develop that. But that's an important thing to recognize in anything we do. You know, it would be, I don't want to get into a political thing. What we associate with and who we associate with also supports other people in their associations. So if we're associating and giving tacit approval to something that we really don't approve of, we should look at it. And don't provide that. That's an important part of just living a well-integrated life. You know, it's important. So, another great class. A few quick announcements. Our retreat starts Thursday. There's still two beds, I think, so if you want to come, we'd like to fill them up. It'd be great to have you. So there will be no class Thursday of this coming week or Saturday, but we will have a class on Tuesday, and then we'll be back to our full schedule next week. Our Dana dinner is on November 21st of Thanksgiving, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. I'll have a flyer out there, but there's info on the Cross River Meditation website, and there's a basket outside. We're taking donations to help Julie. She's been so generous over the years, but to help her pay for the kitchen staff that needs to be there. I found this out at our last dinner that Julie was paying them out of their own pocket. I should have realized it, that they shouldn't be working for free anyway. So we need a couple hundred bucks to pay them. And also Julie asked me this year if we would buy the plates and napkins and those types of things. And again, we should be doing that. So there's a little basket out there for donations for that. And our Donna project is the Raritan Learning Cooperative, which is this wonderful alternative high school in Flemington for kids that had difficult time being forced to learn certain curriculums. And this school, and it's an accredited school, students choose what they want to learn, and they bring in teachers to teach that specific thing. So as a Sangha, whoever wants to be a part of that can write a paragraph or two of what they'd like to offer, and it could be anything. And we're going to make a little catalog, and it will be presented there at the school, and the kids can say, oh, yeah, I want to learn what it's like to be a good lawyer. And they'll call up Anthony, and Anthony will go and teach a little bit. Or how to make beautiful jewelry like Diane makes. Or anything. They might even ask to learn about meditation. Or anything else that we have to offer. So that's our ongoing Donna project. It doesn't cost money. They'll certainly take donations there, too. Maybe I'll get a basket out for that. But it's really more of donating our time and our expertise to kids that, like us, are looking for another way of looking at the world. And I just think it's a great project. And Mary Beth is part of our Sangha. She'll be going on retreat too.
Is it in Flemington or Princeton?
Flemington. There's three schools that are part of this learning cooperative. One is in Princeton, one is in Flemington, and one is in Bucks County somewhere. I can't remember where.
Cool.
Yeah, it really is. They already have five kids in Flemington, and they're looking for more. I just think it's one of, when I was in high school, I loved the idea of learning. My whole life I have. But I just couldn't stand high school, and it really was because I'm one of those people that you can't tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. I've always been a touch rebellious that way.
Like it's a wonderful school. My God, my youngest son would have benefited from.
Yeah, I know. It's a.
I would.
I think. I mean, hopefully, I don't. You know, it's like the idea of the Dhamma taking over the world. Hopefully, the motto will spread, and we'll realize that we shouldn't constrain kids so much in that environment. Some kids thrive in it. You know, I knew plenty of kids that did. I didn't. Okay, that's enough for today. We'll finish with metta as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision and being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.